This is an ABC podcast.
Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. This is David Rutledge. Another week, another mass shooting in the United States, and another round of conspiracy theorists inhabiting the darker corners of YouTube and social media, saying that the tragedy was a false flag operation, that someone from the progressive liberal side of politics actually orchestrated a massacre of children at an elementary school in order to strengthen the case for gun control. It sounds incredibly stupid. Conspiracy theories almost always sound incredibly stupid. And that's why we've heard a lot of concerned commentators over the past few years saying that what we need as an antidote to the stupidity is more rational thinking, more philosophical training, better education. But my guest this week makes the observation that you don't have to be stupid to be a conspiracy theorist. In fact, many of them are highly intelligent and well-educated. And he has a very interesting analysis of the lure of conspiracy theory, of why people get into it in the first place.
In my paper, I give the example of the many intellectuals who supported the Nazis during World War II. The machinations of the Nazi regimes, not least its conspiracy theories about Jews, appealed very strongly to philosophers. Martin Heidegger comes to mind, as well as to jurists, scientists, and linguists. And it was the linguists who were responsible for translating these strange and complex conspiratorial tracts, like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which originally appeared in Russian. So I don't think the problem here is that these people are not smart enough to recognize the reality. There's something else very different going on, and I'm suggesting that it has to do with the motivation that's behind aesthetic appreciation.
Charles Blatberg is professor of political philosophy at the University of Montreal. Late last year, he published a paper in the Philosophical Forum titled Antisemitism and the Aesthetic. I've put a link to it on the Philosopher's Zone website. And if, like me, you've spent a lot of time wondering why on earth so many apparently sane people get sucked down these rabbit holes of paranoid nonsense, then it's a paper well worth reading. And today's program is a conversation well worth sticking around for.
My central claim when it comes to conspiracy theories are that they're not, at least first and foremost, they're not functionalist, by which I mean that they're not primarily designed to meet some external end, whether political, psychological, economic, religious, or other. Rather, they're all about enjoyment. And enjoyment comes from affirming things for their own sakes, rather than because of some interest we may have. When we do that, we need to take a disinterested attitude towards whatever it is that we're affirming. And when we do that, we access what I like to call the aesthetic dimension of reality. And that's all about enjoyment. And there are essentially four ways of doing this. Savoring beauty, obviously, but also playing for fun, putting on shows or spectacles, and fantasizing. And I would say that all four are involved when we entertain conspiracy theories, or at least those that are plainly false. Because obviously, there are some conspiracy theories that are true. Watergate is a good example. But when it comes to the plainly false ones, that the earth is flat, say, or that Jews secretly run the world, these ones, I wouldn't say the problem with those who entertain them is that they suffer from a rationality deficit, which I guess is just a polite way of saying that they're stupid. Rather, it's that they are clearly intelligent people who are enjoying these theories. And in fact, sometimes the theories are so intricate and all-encompassing that you have to be capable of highly complex thought just to grasp them. And I'd go even further and suggest that intellectuals who are very attracted by complexity are just the kinds of people who enjoy, first of all, theorizing, and second of all, theorizing about conspiracies. When you do that, it's very much like playing a puzzle-solving game. And, you know, by uncovering the plot, players pass tests of ingenuity. And in this way, they participate in one of the modes of the aesthetic, that one that I've identified as playing for fun.
Yeah, but one thing that strikes me about a lot of conspiracy theorists is that they don't seem to be taking much pleasure in the game. It can't be much fun to walk around believing that the deep state is trying to control your mind with chemtrails or whatever it might be. And it doesn't look like they're having fun. They often seem driven by anger and fear. So it raises the question of what kind of pleasure, what kind of fun are they having?
Well, I think if you closely examine that anger and fear, you'll see that these are aestheticized versions of these emotions. The anger is often that of the self-righteous, virtue-signaling battler against evil, someone who sees him or herself as playing a role in this fantastic morality play, which obviously is a kind of show, and that's another mode of the aesthetic. As for the fear, well, I again would claim that it's not the practical fear that comes from perceiving a genuine threat. Rather, it's something much more enjoyable, you know, like when you're sitting comfortably in a cinema and you're watching a good horror movie. In fact, conspiracy theorists also often enjoy the aestheticized fear that they instill in others. That's why they're like the villains in fairy tales or comic books who seem to be having a really great time because they're always gleefully cackling and rubbing their hands together. So the point is they're having a great deal of fun. And that's why I think rage and fear is not quite what's going on, except for those forms of these emotions that you can actually enjoy because they've been aestheticized.
So where does that leave the question of belief? Because if I'm taking aesthetic pleasure in a game, I don't necessarily expect that the game has real-world applications or relevance or real-world consequences. But conspiracy theorists seem to have very passionately held beliefs about things that they think are happening in the world, in which case it's not just a game to them. Or is that belief in some sense questionable to you?
Well, once again, I think we need to distinguish between serious practical beliefs or scientific beliefs and those that have been aestheticized. And so what I'm suggesting is that conspiracy theorists, they don't believe in their theories in that serious sense, but rather they believe in them. And you can't see me, but I'm putting little quotation marks around the word there, because this is an aestheticized epistemology, which once again is very enjoyable, especially since they don't see how this belief takes place within this distinct dimension that I'm calling the aesthetic. So if we distinguish between the aesthetic and other dimensions of reality, like the practical and the natural, well, the problem with the conspiracy theorist or really any other kind of aesthete, which are, you know, people who dedicate their lives to the modes of the aesthetic and the enjoyment that comes from them, they don't distinguish between these dimensions as we do, normal people, in the sense that they don't distinguish between the separate world of a game on the one hand or a fantasy that's definitely fictional and the serious non-fictional world where you and I are right now having this discussion. And so because they blur the boundaries between these dimensions of reality, they themselves can't really distinguish between serious, genuine belief on the one hand and the kind of belief that you need to imagine when you're playing a game or enjoying a fictional story, whether it's a film or a novel or whatever. And since they're unaware of that difference, we have to be careful to be aware of just that when we're dealing with them, because you can very easily fail to see this and then take them too seriously. And even though I'm arguing that they're aiming for having fun and enjoyment, that's precisely what I think makes them so dangerous. Because they're not taking life seriously in the way one should. And you know what can come from that, especially in the case of some conspiracy theories that have been very useful to fascists and other extreme political movements.
Yeah, we really see that too, that aestheticization when the whole thing just gets let off the leash. I mean, one of the things that I just find so head-spinning about looking at old footage of Nazi rallies and that sort of extreme aestheticization that the Nazis indulged in. It really has this sense of things just operating at a fever pitch. You know, it's almost like a sort of a hallucinogenic dream that everybody's in, and it makes it all the more terrifying, doesn't it?
Absolutely, especially when, again, there isn't the kind of distinctions that's necessary that we make every day when we distinguish between enjoying a piece of fiction on the one hand and taking politics, for example, seriously on the other. Especially when it comes to politics, that's extremely dangerous. There seems to be a connection between fascism and aesthetics. It's something that the German Jewish writer Walter Benjamin underlined. And part of it seems to involve the need to invent scapegoats for the fact that sometimes life can be difficult, things aren't going well, and we need someone to blame, even if this is all being done within what is essentially a kind of game. The danger is, of course, that it then leaks out of the game into real life, and there are real victims from that.
What interests me about your work is that while so many observers of conspiracy theory call on sociology or psychology, perhaps, to explain what's going on, you turn to metaphysics, in particular the atomistic and the monistic character of aesthetic phenomena. Can you outline that for us?
Right. Well, essentially, it's because I see this aesthetic dimension as different from both the practical dimension and the natural dimension, in that only the aesthetic is both monistic as well as an atomic whole. Now, by monistic, what I mean is that it's cohesive. It exhibits a oneness, which is obviously what contrasts with pluralism, which implies fragmentation. Now, that the practical dimension is to a degree fragmented is, I think, evident from the fact that we sometimes face irreconcilable moral dilemmas in our lives, the kinds from which we can't escape without doing something wrong and so dirtying our hands. As for the natural dimension, it's also fragmented to a degree. Most of it is obviously well described by the systematically unified laws of physics. However, physicists have also identified singularities in the universe, places where there's infinite gravity, and so the laws of physics break down. So you can think of the universe just before the Big Bang, or what's apparently at the center of black holes. So here we have a degree of fragmentation even in the natural world. But when it comes to the aesthetic dimension, well, it's unified, or at least we can imagine it in that way. And if we go back to Carl Philipp Moritz, who is a German author who wrote the very first essay on the link between disinterestedness and aesthetics way back in 1785, so well before Kant and Schiller took up the idea, Moritz argues that an aesthetic phenomena is complete in itself. And I interpret that to mean that there are no gaps in it. And so that's why I would say that it's unified and so monistic. As for the aesthetic and the stuff inside it as atomic wholes, as atomist, where the natural and the practical dimensions have blurry and so holistic boundaries, I take inspiration from, there's a poem by Rainer Maria Rilke on the ball, which leads me to conceive of the aesthetic as like a ball, in that it and the stuff inside it is discrete and self-enclosed. That's why we can approach it by taking a disinterested stance. And that's exactly what you need to do when you're playing with a ball. I mean, just look at the body language of a kitten when they play with a ball. Now, if we go back to conspiracy theories as aesthetic phenomena, well, it's often been remarked that such theories have a self-sealing quality. This indicates that they're both self-enclosed, and so atomic wholes, and they're also cohesive, and so monistic. And that's why they're almost impossible to debunk, because any external countervailing evidence is immediately dismissed, along with any accusation that the theory is in any way self-contradictory and so not a cohesive unity. So I think by recognizing these two metaphysical qualities, the way in which the theory is an atomistic whole on the one hand and unified on the other, we once again identify commonality with all other aesthetic entities. And so once again, we see that at the end of the day, we're dealing with something that's first and foremost about enjoyment and not about functional external ends.
You're listening to The Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge, and my guest this week is the Canadian political philosopher Charles Blatberg. As I mentioned earlier, he has a paper on the aesthetic appeal of conspiracy theorizing that I think is very persuasive, and it's just a great read. You'll find a link on the Philosopher's Zone website. I'm interested in the question of political allegiance and why you think conspiracy theorists tend to cleave to the same rather narrow set of political ideologies. Because if you're right and this tendency springs from an inclination to take aesthetic pleasure in game playing, then that's just a human characteristic. And if we look at the USA, you know, we might expect to find that it's as common among Democrat voters as it is among Republican voters. But generally speaking, we don't find that. Why not, do you think?
Well, okay, I guess in general, there is a tendency of those on the right to be more vulnerable and attracted by conspiracy theories. But we also have to recognize that those on the left can do so as well. Okay, on the right, we have, let's say, in the United States, conspiracy theories like the QAnon theory, or now in the Republican Party, it's very popular to go along with the completely ridiculous claims of the former president that he had the election stolen, the last election stolen from him. But on the left, I think we could point, for example, to the claims that I'm reading nowadays regarding the incredible failures on the behalf of public health authorities to properly deal with the COVID pandemic. Many people point to that and argue that, oh, it must be the result of some neoliberal capitalist conspiracy, when in fact, it seems to me, what the real problem here is massive incompetence verging on the criminal. And that's something that is often underestimated by people who are attracted to conspiracy theories, whether you're on the left or the right. And that is just how incompetent we can be sometimes. Conspiracy theorists just seem often unable to recognize that oftentimes things don't work out very well, and what they're witnessing is not some elaborate secret cabal or organized conspiracy, but it's just simply pure incompetence. And that's the most realistic explanation of what in fact is going on. It's not a lot of fun, though, to recognize that that's the case. And I think that there's even an escapism there when people hope for a kind of perfect, once again, unified world, when the reality is much more broken and fragmented.
I take your point, and yet what really fascinates me about this moment in our culture is that if we look back to the 1960s, we see a familiar kind of anarchic inversion of dominant social values taking place, where the name of the game then as now is provocation and outrage and trolling, and there's a strong aesthetic associated with that. But in the 1960s, it's the hippies and the freaks trolling the conservatives, whereas today the ones who seem to be having all the fun identify as conservatives, and the name of the game is owning the left, with the progressives now the ones clutching their pearls. Do you see it that way? And if so, how do you account for that cultural switch?
Well, I don't actually think that today those who are out to shock and provoke are conservatives so much as political, or should I say anti-political, actors who are far to the right of them. So people like white supremacists and other neo-fascists. And it seems to me that what they have in common with the hippies of the 60s is obviously not ideology, but marginality. Because it's always those who find themselves outside of the establishment that tend to enjoy provoking moralizers and playing the transgressive clown or tricksters. So that's what seems to me that what they have in common, much less than political ideology.
Well, I'd like to turn to anti-Semitism as a particular branch of conspiracy theory. You've written about how the puzzle-solving aspect of conspiracy theorizing can often receive support from fantasy. What role does fantasy play in anti-Semitic imagining?
Well, there is this figure of the Jew, and once again, I'm using quotation marks there because it's clearly not actual Jews that are playing this role within the imagination of the anti-Semite, but it's this aesthetic entity. It's a figure that plays the role of what I call a substantive symbol, which is distinct from formal symbols, the kind that you find in mathematics or logic. The substantive symbol of the Jew has both certain trans-historical formal properties, but these are combined with evolving contents. And that's where you get these different myths and conspiracies, such as that Jews enjoy killing babies and using their blood for religious rituals, or that they're behind engineering immigration policy in order to increase the non-white population. All of that seems to me to be indicative of the fantasy that is underlying a big part of conspiracy theorizing. And that, again, is one of the major modes of the aesthetic. When you use your imagination not to capture something real, when, for example, you are in a conversation and you're trying to be empathetic to your interlocutor, but rather you just let it run free, well, that's fantasy, and that plays a major role in the enjoyment of conspiracy theories. And the thing about anti-Semitism is that sooner or later, it always ends up taking the form of a conspiracy theory.
Yeah, it seems to me that there's a connection here between the aesthetic pleasure you're describing and the kind of pleasure that people take in narrative, you know, that being swept away by an exciting story, in this case, the various accounts of Jewish villainy that we see being told and retold down the centuries. It's very much like a literary encounter, isn't it? That pleasure that we all take in hearing a very conventional story told very conventionally with all the familiar elements in place.
Yes, and once again, these stories are populated by this figure of the Jew, who is also someone that the anti-Semite savors, savoring being one of the other modes of the aesthetic, the appreciation of beauty or even ugliness. So you can think of how anti-Semites savor the exaggerated hooked noses, dark beady eyes, and drooping eyelids of the ugly, swarthy, hairy Jew, depicted in many relished caricatures and cartoons. Or you can think of the seductive allure of La Belle Juive, a figure either sinful or noble. Anti-Semites simply eat this stuff up because they enjoy it immensely. And so once again, we have fantasy playing a role in making conspiracy theories a source of aesthetic pleasure.
So if we go back then to our earlier discussion of atomism and monism, that metaphysical framework that undergirds conspiracy theorizing, how does that framework lead some people to focus on Jews in particular as the primary object of suspicion?
Well, specifically when it comes to monism, I don't think the myriology, the science of parts and wholes, and so atomism versus holism plays a major role here, but the monism pluralism dichotomy does. And that's because historically, Jews have been associated with non-monistic ways of seeing the world. That's true both of religious Jews and secular Jews. So if you look at religious Jews such in philosophy, such as Hannah Arendt or Emmanuel Levinas, Judith Butler, or myself for that matter, you have the idea that it's God who is one, as Moses purportedly declared. And the implication here is that since the world must be intrinsically different from its creator, then the world must be, if not pluralist, then at least disunified. As for secular Jews, while there's not a few of them, at least amongst the leading intellectuals, that have been monists, so you can think of Spinoza to Marx, Freud, and Einstein, many others have been otherwise, from Isaiah Berlin to Jacques Derrida, Judith Sklar, and Michael Walzer. Or you can even look to Yiddish, secular Yiddish culture. I don't know if you like the show Curb Your Enthusiasm, created by Larry David.
I like it very much, yeah.
The character he plays, a fictionalized version of himself, is a classic within secular Yiddish culture. It's known as the Shlemiel, which is essentially a bungler who's always either breaking things or stumbling on already broken ones in ways that make the situation worse. While much of the humor of the show revolves around conflicts over minutiae in daily social life, in which Larry takes one side and some unfortunate friend or acquaintance or passerby takes the other. And what happens, the outcome here, is that you highlight that there are these small and seemingly irreconcilable gaps in the everyday. And in doing so, Curb Your Enthusiasm sends the message. It's a lot of fun, but there's also something serious being said. And the message is that the world is broken. And that, once again, is a theme that runs through much Jewish thought. And so if you're a monist, whether because you subscribe to the doctrine explicitly, because you're a philosopher, or just because you tend to approach the world that way without even ever having heard of the philosophy, if you think that the way things are meant to be is they're all supposed to fit together in a unified oneness, well, here's this culture within the West that historically has stood for disunity rather than unity. And so there you go. That's why those who are monists and are vulnerable to conspiracy theories tend to focus on the Jew as their targets.
Is this what Heidegger was getting at when he wrote that Jewry is the principle of destruction? He probably wouldn't have enjoyed Curb Your Enthusiasm, but he would have appreciated the worldview.
I think so. I think Heidegger is another monist philosopher. He himself conceives of being as providing the horizon for Dasein, for individual beings in the world. And what is a horizon if not a circular boundary in which what's inside is conceived as free of gaps and so unified? And so even though Plato, among others, or among Heidegger's chief philosophical enemies, one thing he shared with them is this belief in monism, which after all has been dominant in Western philosophy, whereas the Jew for Heidegger stood for destruction because he was a pluralist. And that's why anti-Semitism plays such an important role in Heidegger's thought. Obviously, it's only since the publication, relatively recent, of his Black Notebooks that we see just how far he went with this to a genocidal extent, actually. But it's important that we recognize that it's not an ordinary anti-Semitism, but a fundamentally metaphysical kind, in which, once again, we have a monist for whom pluralism, difference, and fragmentation is seen as a threat and so needs to be eliminated. And that's why Heidegger claimed that Judaism is the principle of destruction and so needs to be literally wiped out.
You mentioned that there have been many Jewish thinkers who have been monists, and I'm thinking also of the kind of activity that we see in things like Talmudic biblical interpretation and rabbinic commentary on the Torah, in some forms of Kabbalistic hermeneutics, where interpretation of the sacred text is based on the understanding that there is nothing in that text that is contingent or accidental. Everything comes from God. So the meanings of the words, but also the numerical values of the letters, even the shapes of the letters, it all has divine significance, and it's all sort of contained within the unity of God. And it seems like you have and not only an atomistic and a monistic metaphysics there, but you even have something that looks weirdly analogous to conspiracy theorizing, right? Everything's significant. Everything adds up to a mind-blowing truth if you know how to read it properly. What do you make of that connection?
Well, I read these Jewish traditions very differently. I mean, yes, it's true. There's a plethora of meaning there, both in Rabbinic Judaism and Kabbalah. But I wouldn't say that that meaning fills in all the gaps when it comes to the conception of the world. And so it goes against the idea that the world is to some degree broken and so in need of repair. With the Talmud, the central text of Rabbinic Judaism, these volumes contain, innumerable inconclusive debates between rabbis. And that's why Aidan Steinsaltz, one of the greatest Talmudicists of the previous century, describes the Talmud as essentially a collection of paradoxes. As for Jewish mysticism, well, the great 16th century Kabbalist Isaac Luria had a cosmogony, a story of the origin of the universe, that's known as the breaking of the vessels. And the idea here is that when God created the world, rays of light emanated from him or her. And while these were supposed to be contained within vessels, they ended up overflowing and shattered into fragments. And so that's why I think that at the end of the day, there's a recognition of gaps and fragmentation in both of these major Jewish traditions. And these gaps are utterly incompatible with especially the monistic philosophical principle known as the principle of sufficient reason. So according to this principle, everything must have a reason, cause, or a ground. And that's why there's an important difference that needs to be emphasized between the two main sources of Western civilization. So on the one hand, there's that of Athens, by which I mean to refer to Greek theoretical philosophy and monisms such as Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, all of which more or less can be said to have adopted the principle of sufficient reason. Whereas on the other hand, there's the spirit of Jerusalem, which again, I'm claiming is not at all monistic. And so we have a very different view that's much more open to brokenness, and that brings with it the need to repair the world. There's, in fact, in Kabbalah, there is an important maxim where it's the moral obligation of Jews to contribute to the repair of the world, tikkun olam in Hebrew.
Well, I think your analysis of conspiracy theorizing and of anti-Semitism is just fascinating, but does it also provide tools or strategies that could help us to combat anti-Semitism, to push back against it, or to deal effectively with conspiracy theorists?
Well, I think it does. I think that if we recognize that the plainly false conspiracy theories are essentially aesthetic rather than practical, then this points to very particular ways of combating them. In my work in political philosophy, I've tried to emphasize a dialogical approach, one that would give conversation a greater role in conflict resolution and so in politics. However, dialogue is not always appropriate. And it seems to me that when it comes to conspiracy theorists, dialogue is not only useless, but it can sometimes even be harmful, since it can confer practical legitimacy on the theorist. Now, normally, the attempt to coax aesthetes out of the aesthetic is a mug's game. When people have fallen for a myth, facts usually won't convince them to abandon it. So that's why instead of earnest dialogue, which is fundamentally serious because practical, I think we need to confront anti-Semitic conspiracy theorists on their own terrain, so to speak. And this means going into the aesthetic, which is where they are. So we need, for example, to try and undermine the substantive symbols that conspiracy theorists rely on, such as the figure of the Jew in the case of the anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. And this can be done by, for example, creating and supporting artworks that contest these symbols, as well as the myths that rely on them. Or another option would be to use humor, which is a very significant aesthetic weapon, Because after all, what could be more fitting than mocking and so having fun at a conspiracy theorist's expense? Rather than trying to reason with the anti-Semite and convince them that maybe there's something not quite working with the theory, we frankly need to fight them. And one of the tools of that, especially for someone who is already inhabiting the aesthetic, is mocking. So I'm actually serious about the humor because I think it can be an effective way of ruining their fun and making the conspiracy theory that much less attractive to them.
How much value do you see in political opposition to monism, given that there's so much nationalism bound up in conspiracy theorizing, or at least in the communities that give themselves over to this? Is there something to be gained by, you know, pushing for multinational models of the state over the nation state model, that kind of thing?
Absolutely. As a Canadian, we still have a ways to go, but we have made a fair bit of progress on recognizing that our country is multinational. It's not a one nation, one state. We have the majority nation of English Canadians, of which I'm a part of, but there's also French-speaking Quebecois, and the First Nations are Indigenous nations. It seems to me that one of the problems or obstacles to recognizing multinational reality of a country like Canada or Australia as well, or United States, even Britain, although they've also made a great deal of progress, is precisely the influence of monism, this time on political thought. Yes, the idea of the nation state was born centuries ago with the Treaty of Westphalia, but I think there's a very good reason why it's believed that every nation deserves its own separate state. And that is, once again, a monistic belief that has caused an incredible amount of damage and worse in the world. The fact is there are, according to some anthropologists, a few thousand nations, national communities. And as we know, in the United Nations, there's 194 states right now recognized. There's no way that every nation can have a state. It's a recipe for bloodshed. And so it's extremely important that we make room for multinationalism throughout the world. And once again, one way of doing that is combating the influence of monism on political thought.
Charles Blatberg, Professor of Political Philosophy at the University of Montreal and the author of Anti-Semitism and the Aesthetic. It's a wonderful paper that came out late last year, and I've put a link to it on the Philosopher's Zone website. As always, you can follow us and find all our past programs via the ABC Listen app, and you can find me, David Rutledge, on Twitter at David P. Zone. Thanks for your company this week, and I hope you can join me next time. Bye for now.